From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Bosnian writer Dragana Obradovic was only 8 years old when war broke out in the former Yugoslavia, and her family fled the region as refugees. She remembers the war, but she was too young to understand it.
It was only when I was maybe in my early 20s that I started asking questions about my identity and where I had come from.
Today we continue our month-long series about international literature. But first, I'll be joined by Rebecca Cruz to discuss British Prime Minister Theresa May's speech that outlined Brexit and China's cancellation of more than 100 coal-fired power plants.
Whether the official statement is about the environment, we've seen what coal can do.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. Rebecca Cruz, President-elect Trump is being, I guess he becomes president today. So we're not going to talk about that, though. But something related is the Brexit issue. We've talked about it a lot on this show. But this week, Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, gave this very important speech about the need to break away. She's like, let's just get on with it, more or less. She hopes to have a final deal by March of 2019. I mean, they're still looking 2 years away. And basically that there will be no partial membership. There will be no like staying in the single market, that there will have to be a new partnership, a new arrangement with Europe. But there's been a lot of response to this. And still, even though they voted, nobody's really on board about this.
Yeah, she came out and essentially literally said, let's move on with it. It's going to be a hard break, a hard Brexit. And as you said, she wants to get out of the single market. There was some discussion that they would leave the European Union, but there would be negotiations to stay within the market. But because Britain is trying to gain control or regain control of migration and to get out from under the thumb, or as they perceive it, of the European Court of Justice, this is not going to be possible to stay within the market. And the other reason is they want to be able to negotiate free trade agreements and other trade agreements beyond the European Union. And so, again, being within the market is not going to be possible to do that. So this was a really important speech to kind of outline where they're going, and one of the few speeches so far that has really given a couple of details. So that was significant. She came forward saying that she wanted to unify, that the discord that had been in the country, you know, now is the time to come together and move forward, really focusing on Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. Of course, larger populations there, the majorities there, wanted to stay within the European Union, and there has been some talk about them breaking from Britain in order to stay in the Union. So she's really trying to kind of rally everyone together. Now, it's probably pretty optimistic that this is going to happen so quickly, and optimistic that they're going to get the terms that they want. Although across the channel, you know, in Germany and other countries, they are saying that, yes, they are friends, but it's going to be a complicated situation.
Complicated, and it's going to really require some skilled negotiating. I mean, this is not going to be easy. And as we've pointed out many times, the issues they deal with there are very similar to some of the things that have been brought to the forefront here. And so watching how this plays out in Europe and how the Trump administration responds to that, I mean, he has obviously said a great deal about how Great Britain is doing great after Brexit. So we will see how those things develop. Well, let's move over to China and talk about how this week they canceled more than 100 coal-fired power plants. Now, of course, China is known for operating very large numbers of coal-fired power plants. But the official statement was that they were canceling these plants because they were seen to be wasteful. There might be some environmental reasons behind it, but we can't really tell. But the Chinese demand for energy is tremendous. And so how this will ultimately play out, too, is a big question.
Well, it's interesting. China had proposed or explained a couple of years ago that they were going to limit significantly their coal producing capacity by 2020. And so in doing this, they are making that a more likely reality. So what's also interesting is in the last couple of years or so, even as coal capacity has increased, the usage of coal has actually decreased. So there has been kind of a push towards your cleaner energies, and the demand for those energies have increased. And you and I have both been to China. You know, whether the official statement is about the environment, we've seen what coal can do. We know scientists have proven that coal is the biggest source of greenhouse gases, and a lot of the smog and those sorts of issues, health issues, come from this. So there might be an underlining, but it's certainly a factor.
Still a major challenge there, though, especially because those local communities, I mean, some of these power plants have been in the process for 10 years. Mm-hmm. So the local community really depends on that economically. And so there's also some local pushback. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens politically in China as these communities perhaps resist the central government's demands that they close down.
Absolutely. And some of the areas that are being told to close these projects down are areas that China's had ethnic disputes with. The local governments have quite a bit of autonomy in those areas. So, yes, we'll have to see if they're going to take this proclamation from the central government or if the central government's going to have to become more detailed and go in and actually close them down.
So environmentalists will have to wait to see if this is good news or not. All right, Rebecca, thank you so much. Good to see you back here in the studio.
You too.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzek Rolat. Next, I'll talk with Dragana Obradovic. She grew up in Bosnia and was only 8 years old when war engulfed the Balkans. She began studying Slavic literature to gain a better understanding about herself and her homeland. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. Dragana Obradovic is a professor in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at the University of Toronto. She grew up in the former Yugoslavia and was a child when the country succumbed to civil war. That experience has helped shape her outlook on literature. Dragana Obradovic, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Dragana, you're from Bosnia and obviously work in the field of literature. You're a young scholar, a young teacher and professor. You must have been very young at a time when the Yugoslav area was falling apart, and kind of how that influenced your interest in literature and working on the literature of the region.
Sure. I was actually 8 when the war started. So yes, I was very young, and I have a very specific experience of the war, which is that of a child. And when I, after we were refugees, we never had a family situation in which we talked about the war and what we had experienced. And when I started studying English literature, English and English and French literature, and it was only when I was maybe in my early 20s that I started asking questions about my identity and where I had come from. We had maintained very strong links with Bosnia and our family. There was lots of family there still, but I had never developed that sort of intellectual curiosity about the region until then. And when I turned to Slavic studies, it was primarily in an effort to solve some biographical questions. And because I think what I was lacking as a child, having experienced the war, was a bit of a broader optic on the issues. And I didn't have the language to intellectually talk about these things. And I started reading, at the suggestion of some friends, various writers who really made me think about precisely this question of intellectual engagement during war, questions to do with how does literature respond to such a traumatic breakdown of social values, of everything that's been known. And in particular, because I had focused a lot on, in my studies as an undergraduate and as a master's student, I had worked a lot on postmodernist literature. And I was really curious to discover that, well, there was this big burgeoning of postmodern playful literature in Yugoslavia in the 70s and 80s. And when the war came in the 1990s, these writers suddenly were dealing with really heavy social matters. And I was interested in how suddenly these literary identities of postmodernism could grapple with issues of genocide with war when these writers had really, in a way, internalized and kind of closed literature off from having a very important social role. And so that's where the ethical question actually came in. What grammar did they find for discussing these social breakdowns? And how did they use that grammar of postmodernism to create a new ethics of literary engagement? So I think that's sort of the short version of my path to this work.
Well, this is so interesting and leads, I think, in many different directions. I mean, I'm curious as to kind of what you meant by the having experienced the war as a child, you had a broader optic on it. And then you had that experience, very important experience of being a refugee.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've, when I think about the experience of childhood during war, it can seem, and there are actually other writers from the region who've now written about this, like Sasha Stanisic, who's a writer who works in German, who wrote a book entirely from a child's point of view during the war. And I find a lot of correlates between my own experience and that, insofar as the child has a figurative interpretation of the events that are happening. And the limited understanding is something that, in my mind, I wanted to overcome when I was an adult. I wanted to understand what precisely was happening in those years. And literature, it was part of my education of that. So sort of what were the big questions of politics, of governance, of geopolitics of that time. I was interested in discovering all of that. But often child narrators in war literature are very useful for a writer because precisely this not understanding can throw into relief some types of insights about war. So I guess that's something that when I think about those years, I really did have a very very limited understanding of what was happening, and in a way, a rationalized understanding. For instance, it's the siege, so we don't go to school. So we play all day indoors. and these types of mechanisms of rationalizations, I think, are very common with children. And so the horror, in a way, is perhaps not as profoundly felt. But what I felt as I grew up and I started to work on this literature was, I felt an absence of a certain type of identity that, in a way, I think children of the war, this generation, maybe my generation and a little bit older, so kids who were born in the early 80s, felt that we were born in Yugoslavia and our formative years, our teenage years, were in the post-Yugoslav period where everything was splintered. And so we had no access to a stable identity. And we still felt a loss for Yugoslavia, but it was this very idyllic childhood period. We had not been formed in it as adults. And so that's the absence that I felt actually in my early 20s. And when I started reading this literature, I wanted to know, did I actually have a right to call myself a Yugoslav? I wanted to explore those questions. And literature in particular, much more so than other intellectual and academic texts, answered those questions because it was about those existential crises that people faced. And it was about the perhaps also the affect of the war, that war makes us, war and loss of, and the loss that it engenders makes us feel so many different things.
That's Dragana Obradovic. She's a professor in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at the University of Toronto. When we come back, we'll talk about ethnic identity in Bosnia. I'm Suzek Rolat, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest is University of Toronto Professor Dragana Obradovic. Just before the break, we were talking about her personal search to understand her identity. Bosnia is a complex country that is governed by three ethnic groups, Serbs, Croats, and Bosnians. I asked Dragana if she herself identifies as Bosnian.
Oh, it's so fraught. It is absolutely fraught. I think, as you pointed out, there is this complexity to the governance that makes Bosnia in so many ways a frozen nation, that its constitution and its legal structures are so immovable and so inflexible, in part because of the Dayton Agreement, but not in entirety, that it's so difficult to actually, for me, when I look at the changes that have been happening in Bosnia since the end of the war, so from 94-95 to the present, really the last, it's the years of transition rather than the immediate post-war reconstruction, it's the years of transition that I have been just so solid and frozen and in a way fossilized. So for example, one of the things that's really hard in Bosnia at the moment is to reopen lots of museums and art galleries, because there is a lot of wrangling over who gets to administer the funding for the art galleries and the museums. Is it the federal government, or is it the government that belongs to the two entities, or is it the local municipalities? And so what ends up happening is that black hole, that legal black hole, keeps expanding, and people have been without museums and galleries since actually before the war. And one of the things that's encouraging is that there have been a growing number of citizen initiatives to put pressure on the government to open up these cultural institutions. And this is where the civic resistance is really important in Bosnia. But it is a completely devastated system culturally. And one of the things that we also see happening is that, for instance, the Bosnian government does not even offer enough funding to the film industry for one movie to be made per year. And so the Bosnian film industry has to rely on this European cooperative model of funding that I think is in a way common to a lot of countries in the region, but it's sort of a micro portrayal of actually how difficult it is to produce culture, for instance, in a place like Bosnia. And that, I think, is part of my frustration with looking at the region and looking at Bosnia in particular. I absolutely identify as Bosnian, and I think there is a certain pressure on people to identify ethnically as Serbs, Muslims, or Croats. But I do belong to a growing number of people who just say, no, we refuse all those three labels, and we want to create a trans category of just being Bosnian, of being from there, and therefore not essentializing who we are and what our lineage is, and sort of making and forcing that as the primary point of identification. It's absolutely not important for me. When I go back to Sarajevo, when I do often, there is a group of friends that I know who feel the same way. And there is growing disenchantment precisely with these ideologies and nationalist ideologies that have forced people into these categories and channeled them through not just, oh, you are Serb, so therefore you are Orthodox, but forced them through particular school curricula. And there are people who are resisting particularly those imposed ideologies. But it is hard when I go back there to see how that depressed climate of lack of cultural funding is going to change. So my disenchantment is that I hope that the civic initiatives that are brewing in the region really do help people, not necessarily overthrow but dislodge that type of absolute power that the government seems to have at the moment.
So this seems to be your focus now, as your forthcoming book is about the literary dissolution of Yugoslavia. So not only did Yugoslavia dissolve, but it seems to be you're suggesting that the literary tradition of the region did as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how the literary world has dissolved? And then is it related to this kind of civic resistance, these civic movements kind of trying to bring them back together? Is that how you're feeling about this?
I think so. I think one of the things that happened after the breakup of Yugoslavia is that this collective identity of Yugoslav literature suddenly became Macedonian literature or Bosnian literature, Serbian literature. And the splintering created, an academic but also a literary environment where suddenly people were nationalized, even though their writing might not actually would fit comfortably within what is perceived as a particular national literature. And this meant that actually the study of literature had to go through a period of an intense politicization. And I think the pressures of the 1990s have disappeared now. And one of the things that I'm really encouraged by is the work that scholars and writers do to bring back together these regions, because the languages are mutually comprehensible. So it, in a way, it benefits everyone to have a broader conversation between Serbian writers and Croatian writers and Bosnian writers, and to pull these audiences together and to share the experience of the past 20 years of transition, which have been pretty difficult for all the countries concerned. And I think that type of the kind of the rise of a very particular capitalism intersecting with post-war trauma has in all countries engendered a lot of disappointments. A lot of people lost social security. A lot of people saw their lives completely dismantled at the loss of after the war, and I think this kind of bitterness about what came is bringing people together again, and they're sharing the experiences of this particular economic moment in a way that people are really struggling to find jobs. Unemployment in Bosnia, I think, is officially at 43%, but unofficially, who knows? That there is, for instance, no free health insurance anymore, and so all of these things are maneuvering people towards much more impoverished lives. And writing about these kinds of experiences, it's what is bringing Serbian, Croatian, Bosnian, Slovenian, Macedonian writers much and filmmakers and artists much closer together. And in fact, that's why I also wrote that article on the question of the headscarf in Bosnia, primarily because it's the film ostensibly deals with war, but it asks questions about what comes after war and how do the most disenfranchised subjects of this country, i.e. orphans, how do they exist in this environment?
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds to me like you have a rather optimistic approach here, that we're bringing people back together in a cultural and literary sense, because they've not only lost their kind of political and economic and social environment in the dissolution of Yugoslavia, but their culture as well. And it sounds to me like you're thinking very positively and optimistically about how that is changing. Is that correct?
Yes, I do have more optimism than I did before. I spent some time in the region actually last year, and so I got to meet the newer generations. I think that's what it is. The younger generations who, for example, have no experience of Yugoslavia. So unlike my generation, who had that idyllic childhood, they came after the mess. But their understanding of forging links with the neighbors is an important step towards finding actually a place in an intensely globalized world. And that is something that I perceive as actually very fascinating, because they don't have recourse to that identity. They don't see themselves as Yugoslav, but they're not afraid to collaborate and to establish these types of working relationships, creative and intellectual. So yes, from that perspective, optimistic, though the background, the economic and the social background, is still extremely impoverished. Yes,
definitely still some challenges there. All right, well, Dragana, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your story. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with University of Toronto professor Dragana Obradovic. You can find more information online at kgou.org and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is part of a partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Sam Dupre produced the show, and Jacob McClellan edited this interview. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gralat.